Welcome to Nice News. This is a broadcast about some unusual and hopefully very interesting topics. I'm Joyce Vesper, your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. On Nice News, we cover information from all over the world on many different topics. It's a time when we can take a time out from the daily news that doesn't always cover the happiest of topics. So please give us a listen. Who knows what might give you a smile or maybe cause you to remember something from another era or pique your interest, such as this article about Chaco Culture Natural Historical Park in New Mexico. The United States didn't blink into being the signing of the Declaration of Independence. The seeds of its existence were sown much, much earlier, said Katie Shea, the National Park and Conservation Area's Tribal Policy Fellow. It's essential to recognize that the nation's origin story is not solely defined by 1776. By the time European settlers began arriving on this country's shore, entire cultures had already come and gone, and hundreds of others were thriving. At Plymouth, for example, the Wampanoag famously taught the pilgrims how to interplant three sisters, that's corn, beans, and squash, for a successful harvest. In what is now Florida, the Seminoles, themselves migrants from the northern lands, met, traded, and sparred with the Spanish. Across a vast tract that includes modern-day New York, the Haudenosaunee, or Iroquois, Confederacy practiced one of the oldest participatory democracies in the world, the principles of which served as a model for the founding fathers. Throughout the park system, dozens of sites honor the deep histories and enduring legacies of Native nations whose stories predate and shape the United States. Shea said, she highlighted Ocmulgee Mounds and Nez Perce National Historical Park, Effigy Mounds National Monument, and her personal favorite, Chaco Cultural National Historical Park. Shea, a member of the Citizens Potawatomi Nation, described her awe at visiting the 34,000-acre site in northwestern New Mexico for the first time when she was in college. It just has, like, the sense of otherness around it, she said. During its heyday, around 1050 CE, Chaco was the center of ancestral Puebloan culture, serving as a massive hub for trade, ceremony, and politics. The inhabitants erected dozens of circular great houses, multi-storied architectural wonders complete with hundreds of rooms, linked via roads to a network of some 150 other complexes in the broader region. Everything at Chaco, from the sandstone walls of the buildings to the elaborately decorated pottery to the pendants fashioned from shells from faraway lands, speaks to the sophistication of the people who were here. Shea believes that visiting Chaco culture can change the way some think about the America's 250th anniversary. When you have a site like Chaco that's very well-traveled and is very well-connected, it's kind of giving you an idea of how many people were actually here in North America long before people came over from Britain or Russia or France or Spain. I think it challenges people to think backwards, Shea continued, to recognize that there was a shared fabric of history before the United States became a United States and became the nation that it is today. This article, Chaco Culture National Historical Park, New Mexico, appeared in the magazine of the National Parks Conservation Association, the winter 2026 edition. And now we move on to Ecuador's Otavalo indigenous people who use anime to inspire pride in their ancient culture and their language. Gonzalo Solano writes the article. Ecuador. High in the mountains of the Ecuadorian Andes, a group of young Otavalo indigenous people is using anime to inspire pride in their ancient culture and language, especially among Otavalo children. They produced an animated short film titled We're Aya that follows the adventures of Aya, a mythical Otavalo warrior, and other characters who interact under the watchful eye of a condor, an iconic bird for the Andean indigenous cultures that symbolizes power and energy. Inspired by the work of legendary Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki, the story takes place in the mountains of Imbabura, a province in the northern Andes that is home to the Otavalo people, known for the handicraft and their textiles. Tupac Amaru, director and producer of the 9-minute film, said the movie is part of an effort to maintain Otavalo customs and language, which began to erode as globalization created a more interconnected world and influenced their culture. His people faced two options: lock ourselves out from the rest of the world and defend our culture, language, spirituality, and clothing, or stand tall and fight back, Amaru said. The film, with 12 Quechua-speaking characters, is a first step in trying to get Otavalo children to appreciate their heritage. Indigenous themes have been explored before in short and feature-length films produced in Peru and Ecuador, but most of those films have had Spanish-speaking characters. Quechua is the vibration that gives meaning to existence, and without that language, the meaning of life and our energy comes to an end. Our children no longer know Quechua, which means that they have lost a communication tool and are losing their sense of belonging and their energy, he added. Quechua, an indigenous language that is part of the Quechua language family, is primarily spoken in Ecuador. Yarik Sisa, creative manager for the film, said the story is inspired by ancestral practices that have survived the passage of time, including taking musical instruments to energetic points of the land the night before a celebration so that the instruments are endowed with soul. The film includes characters such as Ayaruku, which represents an indomitable spirit, Ayawa, a representation of the sublime and the feminine, and Ayaku, a child symbolizing tenderness. These characters play their traditional instruments and stomp their feet as part of a rhythmic dance as they enter a dark cavern, which symbolizes globalization, where the spirits give them the mission of becoming new seeds of their people. The film shows an indigenous grandfather talking to his granddaughter, who promises her elder she will become a woman strong as rock and a defender of their culture. Her grandfather then asks her to never stray from that path. The team behind We're Aya hopes to release more films and even video games in Quechua in the coming years and even enter the international video game market with games made by Quechuas in a Quechua environment, said Malkik Anrago, the film's creative director. This article, written by Gonzalo Solano, Ecuador's Otavalo indigenous people use anime to inspire pride in their ancient culture and language. Sarah Kuta writes, archaeologists discover ancient Roman olive oil production facilities in North Africa. An international team of archaeologists from Italy, Spain, Tunisia have been excavating Henshir El Begar since 2023. Ancient Romans were big fans of olive oil, consuming an average of 5 gallons per person per year by one estimate. Beyond cooking and eating, olive oil played a central role in daily life, serving as a staple for everything from body care and medicine to sports and religious rituals. Now archaeologists have uncovered fresh evidence of just how integral olives were to Romans. Researchers recently unearthed a pair of large olive pressing facilities in present-day Tunisia that operated between the 3rd and 6th centuries. That's according to an announcement from Ca' Foscari University of Venice. They report that one of the complexes may be the second largest known olive oil production center in the Roman Empire. The facilities are located at Henshir El Begar, an archaeological site near the border with Algeria in Tunisia's Kasserine region. Archaeologists from Italy, Spain, and Tunisia have jointly been excavating since 2023. Shedding light on the production, marketing, and transport of olive oil on such a large scale presents an exceptional opportunity to combine research, valorization, and economic development, says Luigi Sperti, an archaeologist at Ca' Foscari University in Venice. Her Begar First may be home to Roman Empire's second largest known civil oil production facility, according to researchers. located in the Jebel Samama mountain range, the region was mostly dry and had large temperature swings, which would have made it perfect for growing olive trees. According to researchers, Tunisia was the primary supplier of olive oil to Rome. Hashir El Begar spans roughly 82 acres and was once part of a large rural estate. It's home to a Latin inscription from 138 CE that authorized the organization of bi-monthly markets, which would have made it a hub for gathering and trade. Researchers have divided Hashir El Begar into two sections. One area, dubbed Her Begar I, is home of the largest known Roman olive oil mill found in Tunisia, the second largest found throughout the entire empire, according to the research. The mill has 12 beam presses, which were used to apply pressure to olives until they released their valuable oil. Her Begar II also has an olive oil plant, although it's slightly smaller, with just 8 beams presses. Both sites have a water collection basin and several cisterns. In 2018, research revealed that the olive oil was being used in Italy by roughly 2000 BCE. Archaeologists also unearthed stone millstones and mills, suggesting Hashir El Begar produced cereal in addition to oil. Additionally, using ground-penetrating radar, the researchers have identified a network of residential roads and structures. Other artifacts from the modern age to the Byzantine era have surfaced, including a bracelet made of copper and brass, a white limestone projectile, and parts of a sculpture. The mission offers an unprecedented insight into the agricultural and socioeconomic organization of the frontier regions of Roman Africa, says Sperti. The Romans were far from the first culture to use, produce, and trade olive oil. Around the year 6000 BCE, inhabitants from eastern Mediterranean began extracting oil from wild-grown olives. They loved this high-calorie, nutrient-rich liquid so much that by 5000 BCE, they were growing olive trees in orchards. Olive oil quickly transformed the way people lived. It was burned as a fuel in lamps. It helped preserve food longer, especially dairy products such as yogurt and cheese, and it enabled a broad cuisine to flourish, providing the foundation of what we know today as the Mediterranean diet. This article, written by Sarah Kuti, archaeologists discover ancient Roman olive oil production facilities in North Africa. Tom Fleischman writes, Bird of Paradise inspires darkest fabric ever made. The color ultra black, defined as reflecting less than 0.5% of the light that hits it, has a variety of uses, including in cameras, solar panels, and telescopes. But it's difficult to produce and can appear less black when viewed at an angle. Now, a Cornell lab has devised a simple method for making the elusive color. Taking cues from nature, in particular the striking black of the magnificent rifle bird, researchers in the Responsive Apparel Design, or the RAD Lab, in the College of Human Ecology, dyed a white merino wool knit fabric with polydopamine, followed by etching of the material in a plasma chamber to create nanofibrils, spiky nanoscale growths. These features were made to mimic the light-trapping capabilities found in the rifle bird's ultra-black feathers, which absorb most of the light that hits them. The researchers' two-step approach produced the darkest fabric currently reported. It's also easy to manufacture, scalable, wearable, and not angle-dependent. The researchers have applied for a patent production with the Cornell Center for Technology and hope to form a company around the process, which can be used on natural materials such as wool, silk, and cotton. From a design perspective, I think it's exciting because a lot of the ultra-black that exists isn't really as wearable as ours, and it stays ultra-black even from wider angles. Shepherd's RAD Lab director is senior author of Ultra-Black Wool Textiles, inspired by hierarchical avian structure. The work included analysis of features and feathers from the rifle bird, a member of the Bird of Paradise family found in New Guinea and Australia. Shepherd and her team obtained rifle bird feathers from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology with the help of Mary M. Ferraro, bird collections manager, and Vanya Royer, curator of bird and mammal. a dress designed by Zoe Alvarez, a fashion design major and inspired by the magnificent Rifle Bird, uses the ultra black material and the deep black fabric. The ultra black fabric created in the Response of Apparel Lab is the darkest fabric currently on report. The Rifle Bird's striking black plumage comes from melanin pigment combined with tightly bunched barbules that serve to deflect light inward, absorbing nearly all of it. This renders the bird extraordinarily black, but only when viewed straight on. It wasn't enough to simply coat the surface of the wool. The researchers have to polydopamine penetrate into the fibers of the fabric, so every bit of it becomes black. That's because the plasma etching process removes some surface material of the outermost fibers, leaving behind filaments, which are a key component. The light basically bounces back and forth between the fibrils instead of reflecting black. That's what creates the ultra black effect. The ultra black fabric has potential in many solar thermal applications, converting and utilizing absorbed light into thermal energy. We could actually use the ultra black fabric for thermal regulating camouflage. Last fall, Zoe Alvarez, a fashion design management major, created a black strapless dress inspired by the Rifle Bird that incorporated at its centerpiece ultra black material with a splash of iridescent blue. Images of the dress were used to confirm Ultra Black's true blackness. When the image's contrast hue, vibrance, and brightness were adjusted, all other colors changed, but the Ultra Black remained the same. This article, written by Tom Fleischman, Bird of Paradise Inspires Darkest Fabric Ever Made. Well, now we move on to how to keep your mind nimble. And here are five research-backed ways. 1. Read aloud regularly. Read out loud helps you to practice articulation and rhythm, both of which are key to verbal fluency. Bonus, it also helps improve memory retention and comprehension. 2. Mirror work plus record yourself. Speaking in front of a mirror boosts self-awareness and comfort with your own voice. Take it further by recording yourself and playing it back. Yes, it's awkward at first, but it's one of the fastest ways to pinpoint areas to improve. Write by hand. Put pen to paper. Studies show that handwriting activates key brain regions for memory and learning. Old school wins. Crosswords beat brain apps. Sorry, brain training apps, crossword puzzles still reign supreme. A 2022 study found that puzzles outperform digital games in preserving mental sharpness in people with mild cognitive impairment. And think before you speak, literally. Practicing mindful pauses before speaking can enhance clarity and confidence. It gives your brain the second it needs to organize your thoughts, and that's been linked to more effective verbal delivery and reduced stress while speaking. So the next time you catch yourself hunting for the right word, remember, your brain is doing the heavy lifting behind the scenes. Give it the exercise that it needs. This article, 5 research-backed ways to keep your mind nimble. Next article, man donates kidney to woman he met after a crash. In a heartwarming tale of connection and kindness, two individuals brought together by sorrow have transformed their lives through a remarkable act of generosity. Tim Swinburne from Melksham and Claire Brixey from Standerwick have forged a beautiful bond over the years, culminating in a life-saving kidney transplant. Their story began in 2004 when Tim had the difficult task of informing Claire about the tragic loss of her 20-year-old son, Ashley, in a car accident. At that time, Claire was battling kidney failure and depended on dialysis. Despite the weight of their initial meeting, Tim and Claire maintained their connection, and when Tim learned that Claire's previous transplant was no longer working, he stepped forward with a heartfelt offer to donate his kidney. "Giving the gift of life to me is just a human thing to do," Tim expressed. "Anyone with a heart would give something to someone else alive." This incredible act of selflessness came to fruition in October at Southmead Hospital in Bristol, where the 4-hour surgery was a resounding success. Both Tim and Claire are now on the road to recovery. Tim has returned to his role at work, while Claire joyously shared that she's been able to go horseback riding for the first time in years. Their journey doesn't stop here, as both are enthusiastically planning fundraisers for charities that support transplant-related causes. Claire has affectionately described Tim as a man in a million, highlighting the depth of their friendship that has blossomed over the past 21 years. Reflecting on their relationship, Claire said, "He was my family liaison officer, the person who knocked on my door to tell me my son had been killed in a road traffic collision. He was such a compassionate man and very easy to talk to and supportive to our family. We just seemed to gel, and we've been friends for 21 years." Tim echoed the sentiments, noting that the special bond they share, "Claire is one of those special people we've joked over the years. We're like siblings. She's an amazing friend. Over my life, I've made ups and downs, and she's been there for me, and vice versa." When Tim made the decision to offer his kidney, he reassured Claire, even as she expressed concern, "There was no question in my mind. To know she is out there riding her horse again, to see her out there with her granddaughter and daughter, that's the reason I did it." The inspiring story shows showcasing the profound impact of compassion and friendship, reminding us all of the goodness that can come and can emerge even from the most challenging of circumstances. This article, "Man Donates Kidney to Woman He Met After Crash." Inventor creates solar backpack that transforms into a bed and generator for the homeless. Zach Clark's journey began as a freshman at the University of San Francisco when the world was transitioning due to COVID-19. He found himself moving from his dormitory into the Tenderloin, a vibrant yet underserved neighborhood in the Bay Area. From his apartment, Zach started to notice the lives of those living in nearby homeless encampments. What began as mere observation soon blossomed into a meaningful conversation. "I began starting conversations with very people who lived outside my building," he said, reflecting on the connections he formed. Initially, Jack envisioned creating a transitional housing program, but as he listened to the stories of the unhoused individuals in his community, a new inspiring idea emerged: the makeshift traveler backpack. This innovative backpack is equipped with a solar panel generating a remarkable 10,000 mAh of power, Zach explained. "I started makeshift traveler program based on feedback I received from people I spoke with who kept saying they had phones but couldn't charge them, and their belongings were constantly being stolen or damaged. Crafted from recycled water bottles, the makeshift traveler features a hard shell design and incorporates a 4-watt solar panel atop the backpack. The panel connects to a rechargeable power bank nestled inside, providing enough energy for 2 to 3 smartphone charges after just 4 to 6 hours of sunlight. The backpack is more than just a power source. It comes with a nylon pillow that can easily be inflated using a t-shirt. Instead, inside, users will also find essentials such as a tent, a sleeping bag, rain poncho, radio, flashlight, hygiene kits, socks, a water bottle, and a lockbox for personal items. Additionally, it includes an ID card and a brochure detailing 15 local services available to assist the unhoused community. The makeshift traveler was designed to be the last backpack someone experiencing unsheltered homeless will ever need, Zach emphasized, showcasing his commitment to creating lasting solutions. Since its launch in October 2022, over 1,200 makeshift traveler backpacks have been distributed at no cost to individuals experiencing homelessness across 25 California cities. Thanks to the generous support of partners and donors, Zach's nonprofit, the Home More Project, proudly continues its mission. Plans are already underway to distribute an additional 2,000 backpacks with the help of collaborators in other states. As Zach and his team deliver these backpacks, he expresses heartfelt gratitude to every funder, faith-based group, outreach worker, and service provider who plays a role in this impactful work. "Together, we're not only handing out backpacks, we're building relationships, restoring dignity, and showing up for people who are often too overlooked," he wrote. Currently, in its third iteration, the makeshift traveler backpack is set to launch a fourth version, which will incorporate new features based on feedback from those it serves. The continuous improvement reflects Zach's dedication to meeting the evolving needs of the community. One recipient, Steve Kalunga, shared his excitement, stating, "This is really a cool resource," as he received a makeshift traveler backpack to replace his old drawstring bag. For those in need, applications for a makeshift traveler backpack can be made online. Supporters are also encouraged to contribute through donations to help fund additional backpacks and future housing initiatives under Zach's nonprofit. "To me, there's nothing more important than ending homelessness," Zach expressed passionately. "These are to provide these needs and a way for us to meet and build trust with people, to have them open up and share their stories, because they are people, not problems to solve." Through this heartfelt initiative, Zach Clark is not only empowering individuals, but also creating a wave of goodwill and connection within the community. This article, "Inventor Creates Solar Backpack That Transforms Into a Bed and Generator for the Homeless." As we end the show, I'd like to leave you with this quote of the day. It's from Vincent van Gogh. "The more I think it over, the more I feel that there's nothing more truly artistic than to love people." Vincent van Gogh. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's articles. Please join us again next time when we cover some very unusual topics on Nice News. This has been Joyce Vesper, your volunteer broadcaster for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Stay healthy, everyone. Be well. Be happy. Bye-bye.